I'm just gonna introduce myself very quickly. My name is Yoki. I work as a postdoc in Leiden with Joop, and I also collaborate with Roma and Oscar on what I'm about to talk about. And I work on mainly implementing radiation hydrodynamics in Ramses, and I use that to study radiation feedback on galactic scales. And surprisingly, today's topic is feedback, both by supernovae and radiation in a galactic disk simulation. So there is an ongoing effort to try and model realistic galaxies in simulations. And it's been well known for a long time that in order to do so, you need to have efficient supernova feedback. Otherwise, your galaxies are going to be too compact, too star forming, and lacking in outflows. However, if you go into the simulations and you know, try to just put in supernova feedback in a dumb, simple way, it doesn't really work so well. And you're confronted by a more specific overcooling problem, which goes a bit like this. So you have, you know, a box with some volume elements, and you have stars floating around in your volume, and at some point the star wants to go supernova. And the sort of intuitive way of doing it is you just put in the kinetic energy, the thermal energy of the supernova into the cell or volume element which is hosting it. If your resolution is nice, if your resolution is very good, then this pressure is going to just push outwards and you're going to have an expanding adiabatic blast. This is going to just expand outwards adiabatically, and at some point, at some a larger radius that you resolve very well, you have a transition to a kinetic phase, to a momentum-driven phase. However, usually in simulations, you have a much worse resolution than that, and you don't really resolve this transition radius. And what happens then if you put in your thermal energy? Your hydrodynamical time step is going to be short compared to the cooling time. And before the gas can react, the energy is just going to be radiated away. There are other things, there are other complications, of course. There is other physics going on than supernovae. And in particular, there is these kinds of feedback which are not instantaneous like supernovae, but have a chance to sort of pre-process the medium before the supernovae can go off, for example, by reducing the central densities, which can influence the supernova feedback. I'm going to talk about kind of two things in this talk. I'm going to review a few subgrid recipes for supernova feedback which exist in Ramses. I'm doing that because I was asked to talk about that, but also I think it's very good to sort of collect together these recipes which are existing for people to make use of and systematic tests of these recipes. So that when you have to choose between recipes, you know exactly what's happening, what you're choosing between, and you know also when you're using them, why things are as they are in your simulations. The other thing I'm going to talk about is radiation feedback. So here I'm going to step a little bit in the other direction, and I'm going to try to do that actually from first principles, as close as I can do that. Here, people are actually doing doing subgrid recipes for radiation feedback, which have been presented in works previously this week. And here, it's a good idea to try to see how your results compare to those subgrid recipes if you try to do that from first principles. Before I talk about these things, I'm going to show you simulations with these recipes for feedback, and so I'm just going to show you first the setup of the isolated disk simulation that I'm using. So I'm using the Ramses code, which is an AMR code, of course. So I'm simulating a dark matter halo of 10 to 11 solar masses. This is the box, which is about 300 kiloparsec in diameter. And then if you center in on the center here, you find a galactic disk, which is set up with an exponential profile in radius and height. So it's a quasi-hydrostatic equilibrium disk. And it's pretty gas-rich, so it's 50-50 gas and stars by mass. And outside, there's just a CGM of diffuse and hot gas. There is 18 parsec maximum resolution. So remember, this is AMR. So the maximum, the minimum cell width we have is 18 parsec. We apply star formation at densities below, above 10 atoms per cc, and below temperatures of 3,000 Kelvin. So this is the, in this phase diagram of temperature versus density, you see here the temperature criterion and the density here, and the gas, which is colored here, is the star-forming gas. And then we put in this artificial pressure, which is put in there to make sure that you resolve the gene's length by a few cells at any density to prevent spurious fragmentation of the gas. We apply star formation with classical Schmidt law with 2% star formation efficiency. Stellar particles which are formed represent stellar populations, 600 solar masses per particle. And we assume a Chabrier IMF. And in each of these models that we're using, there are, the supernovae are instantaneous, go off at 10 megayears after the birth of the stellar particle. So first supernova recipe, stochastic thermal feedback. This, I actually put that into Ramses myself and adapted it from a recipe by Delvecchia and Shea, which was put into SPH. So the problem, the overcooling problem was, remember, the cooling time is short compared to the hydrodynamical time step. And the solution is to try to increase the heating in the cell where you inject the energy. You may remember that there is a peak in the cooling curve for gas at ISM densities, which is around 10 to the 5 Kelvin, I think. And if you go beyond 10 to the 5 Kelvin, you hit a bottom in the cooling curve. So by heating the gas to these kinds of temperatures, you increase the cooling time a lot. So the recipe is then, you have your parameter, which is just the heating for the cell in which you inject your energy. And then you have to assign a probability for exploding the supernova, which is the available energy in the particle divided by the required energy to heat that cell. And that's then going to scale linearly with the density of that cell. So here are some results for that. I'm going to show results mainly in the form of this Kennicott-Schmidt relation of star formation surface density versus gas surface density. So this is the universally observed relation, which goes as surface density to the power of 1.4. And here I'm just showing first the results with no feedback. So this is at 250 megayears. And this is just taking annuli, so radial bins in the disk. So here's the result with no feedback, and we're clearly overshooting the universal relation quite a lot. Then we apply this thermal dump feedback, which was, remember, the recipe that I told you doesn't work. It doesn't work very well, but there's some change in star formation, at least. Then we put in stochastic feedback with a relatively low heating here, 10 to the 7 Kelvin, and we are still reducing the star formation rates towards the observed relation. We increase the heating, and we're getting closer. But then, if we keep increasing it, we actually start diverging again from the universal relation. And that's because the supernovae become sort of overly stochastic. There is a long time and interval between individual events. And if you do that further, you just go further away from the universal relation. There is, I think Oscar discussed this a bit on Monday, there is a certain degeneracy between your feedback and your star formation efficiency. So you can also actually just change this by fiddling with the star formation efficiency, right? So I tried to do that. You know, if you increase the star formation efficiency, you diverge in this direction. If you decrease it, you do get towards the observed relation. But in doing so, you have to go, factor of 10 down in star formation efficiency. And at that point, if you do the same for no feedback at all, you also get the same Kennicott-Schmidt relation. So that implies there is actually no effect from feedback at these kind of efficiencies, which is clearly not what you want. Another supernova recipe, which has been used, quite a lot, this is a classic supernova recipe, is kinetic feedback. Here the solution to the problem, which is that we're not resolving the transition to the, kinetic phase, is just to skip the thermally driven phase and go directly to the momentum driven phase. So we draw a bubble around the exploding particle, which has some radius, which is a parameter for the recipe. And then we take this multiple of the star, of the stellar mass, and we take that mass out of the central cell, and we redistribute that homogeneously within the bubble, right? And we give that velocities such that, you know, you normalize to the total energy which is available in the particle and available in the supernova, and you redistribute that as kinetic energy inside the bubble with the linearly increasing velocities. So here we try that out with a bubble radius of 150 parsec, mass loading of 1, and there is a clear effect in the Kennicott-Schmidt relation. Star formation rate goes a bit downwards, and we clearly have more diffuse gas than with the thermal dump feedback. And I also checked the wind loading. So this is the mass loading in the recipe, but you can also check the wind 20 kiloparsec away from the face of the galaxy at each light. And then you can calculate the wind ejection rate against the star formation. And in the case of the kinetic feedback, this is about 1. Large scale mass loading is about 1, whereas with thermal feedback, it's a factor of 100 less. So very effective at creating winds. We increase the mass loading parameter that has a bit of an effect of converging towards the observed relation here, but the large scale mass loading is actually less, which may seem a bit counterintuitive, but this is apparently a well-known result, and I think is because you have more mass in these shocks which form in the ejection, and these have higher cooling rate, and therefore you get less efficient feedback. You can also try to have a very, very large bubble radius, and then you sort of completely screw up the Kennicott-Schmidt relation, but you have very, very mass-loaded winds. And what's happening there is just, so here we're showing the disk hadron, so this is just gas density, and this is with the small bubble radius, and this is with the large bubble radius. And what's happening here is you're basically just decoupling the feedback from the gut disk, and you're not supporting it anymore. The last supernova recipe I'm going to talk about is delayed cooling, which has been used quite a lot lately. For example, in explaining this cusp core problem in dwarf halos. So here, the solution to the overcooling problem is just, you know, you just turn off cooling for a while, and there is no problem anymore, right? The physical argument behind that is that there is supposed to be, you know, some non-thermal turbulence on scales that below what you resolve in your simulations, and the delayed cooling represents that somehow. And on scales which, on time scales which correspond to the sound crossing time across that, you know, a few cell widths, which you don't resolve, this should decay, right? And on scales larger than that, the hydrosolver should just maintain the turbulence normally. So what you do, the method is that you inject your energy in the normal way, thermal energy, but at the same time you inject an energy tracer which represents this turbulent energy, which we can write here as a velocity dispersion. You turn off cooling as long as this tracer is bigger than some value, which is a parameter for your recipe. And this tracer is going to move along with the gas, so as the gas pushes outwards, the tracer moves along with it, and it diffuses. And at the same time, it decays according to some time scale which you set, which corresponds to the sound crossing time, ideally. So it's going to disappear after some time, and then you just turn on cooling again. So here is an experiment with delayed cooling. So again, Kennicott-Schmidt relation. I've used here just different values for the dissipation timescale. It basically comes down to the same thing as changing this turbulence limit parameter. And there is a big change, clearly. So we're falling onto the relation, these intermediate surface densities. We're completely rid of high surface gas densities. So the galaxy is being made very diffuse. I tried running as well with a 10 times more massive galaxies, a Milky Way type galaxy. And there you find that you're lying very nicely on the Kennicott-Schmidt relation. So I think the message here is that, you know, you can deal with this overcooling problem with a number of recipes which are available, which can give you a lot of desired effects, but maybe not all the effects at the same time, all the time. It seems to me as well that you know, when you apply these supernova recipes and you fall on to the Kennicott-Schmidt relation, for example, you're probably overdoing supernova feedback because there are other processes going on there. And so you could say in a way that these supernova recipes are maybe representing something other than just supernova feedback. And I think then that it's timely to indeed look at these other processes and try to see if, you know, we are actually representing them in the correct way with these recipes. And that's where we come to the radiation feedback and now using radiation hydrodynamics. So I'm just going to run the same disk again, but turning on the radiation in these simulations. So let's start with the RHT method. This is Ramsey's RT now. It's just Ramsey's with added radiation hydrodynamics. The method has been presented in detail in a paper last year. We're using a moment method with the M1 closure, like we saw earlier today. And yes, it includes in the first, like what's presented in this paper, we have ionization and heating of the gas by the radiation which is being propagated. But then I've also added now radiation pressure directly onto the hydrogen and helium. And I also added reprocessed infrared radiation, which can be modeled with diffusion or just with the N1 method, depending on the optical thickness of the gas. So that allows us to trap the radiation and have multi-scattering in a realistic way. So we include three groups of photons in these simulations. Sorry, five groups of photons in these simulations. So three groups of UV photons, which are the ionizing photons, and they're going to interact with the hydrogen and helium, and they're also going to interact with the dust in a sort of a crude manner. We use a pretty crude dust model in these simulations, where we just assume that there's a constant cross-section with the gas, and we assume the dust content scales linearly with metallicity. And then there's also far ultraviolet radiation and infrared radiation. So we emit into these groups from stellar particles using the SEDs from Brousseau and Charlot, which give us luminosities of the particles as a function of age and metallicity. And these two groups are going to re-emit into the infrared as they're absorbed by dust. Okay. And notice as well that the cross-section here is much lower than in these other species. And this is the only species where you have multi-scattering on the dust. And I think you mentioned at some point that, you know, 10 is probably way too high. 5 is probably even a bit too high. So keep in mind that this is probably an overestimate here. Then for the results, what happens if we add stellar radiation? I'll start just with a couple movies. So first here showing a simulation without any radiation feedback. So just the stellar density here and the gas density. So it rotates along. And we see pretty early on, you know, a lot of clump formation in the stars and the gas. And, you know, you hardly notice any spirals here, at least not in the stellar density. So then we see the same thing, but with the radiation hydrodynamics turned on. And here what you see is the photoionization rate for the UV photons against hydrogen. So you see a lot of blinking in this movie here, and that's just the stars, you know, going on and off. They only last for about 3 megayears, 4 megayears before their radiation, you know, basically turns off because of their age. And what you see here at the end is then a structure which is pretty different from what you saw without the radiation feedback. It's a lot more spiral structure and a lot less clumps than you had before. Then we can compare star formation rates. So here is first just the case with no feedback at all. Then we add supernova feedback, thermal dump supernova feedback, which we know is not very efficient. Then we add only radiation feedback, so no supernova feedback here. And actually, it seems slightly more efficient at damping the star formation than the supernova feedback. But then we add the combination of the two, and star formation rate is nicely damped and sort of stable throughout the 500 mega-year run. So it seems like the sum of these two parts is a little bit more than each on their own. So there seems to be a, you know, a slight boost, you could say, from the radiation. Well, the radiation boosts the effect of supernova a little bit, it seems. We can also look at outflows. So the radiation feedback dumps the star formation rates, but what does it do to the outflows 20 kiloparsec away from the face? So these are just, again, star formation rates, and these are the outflows. So, well, you see that the outflows are very small with thermal dump supernovae. Mass loading here is, you know, a factor of, is about 10 to the minus 1, 10 to the minus 2. And if you add the radiation feedback, you get even less outflow, which is probably just because the star formation is a bit less. So the radiation by itself doesn't seem to have any effect at all on the outflows here. Kendrick-Schmidt relation, again, we sort of get towards the observed relation with the combination of supernova and radiation feedback. We're not quite there, though. And I think, you know, it would be interesting here to try to add some more effective, actually a subgrid recipe for supernova feedback and check what combination gives you the best concordance with the Kendrick-Schmidt relation. The reason that you're getting towards the Kendrick-Schmidt relation is, again, that your galaxy is being puffed up slightly by the radiation feedback combined with supernovae. So the gas surface densities are actually not changing a lot if you compare, just, you know, assume that the points are about the same radius. But if you take a line of sight through the galactic disk, you find that the density peaks are just higher with supernova feedback only than if you have supernova and radiation feedback, which then, you know, with lower density peaks, you also have lower star formation. So then the thing to check is what is the nature of this effect that we're getting from the radiation feedback. There are basically two options. There is the radiation heating from the ionizing radiation onto the hydrogen and helium, and then there is the radiation pressure. So we can just make a very dumb check here, which is to just take away the radiation pressure and see what effect that has on the star formation rates. So here is, again, the star formation rates with, you know, all the feedback combined, supernova, radiation, heating, radiation pressure. And here in this purple line, we take away the infrared radiation and the associated pressure, and actually the far ultraviolet as well. And that seems to have, you know, a pretty mild effect on the star formation rates. And also, if you just take away all the pressure from the radiation, we're still, you know, almost as effective in damping the star formation rates. So it seems from this that the radiation pressure is not negligible, but it's pretty weak in damping the star formation. And we see basically the same thing in the Kendrick-Schmidt relation. You know, you get all the way there by only supernova and radiation heating. And you don't get any additional effect from adding the radiation pressure. We can see sort of more clearly what's going on in these phase diagrams. Again, temperature versus density. So here you have supernova feedback only. This is at 250 megayears. And here you have supernovae plus the full radiation feedback. And the clear difference here is this plateau of gas, which is at about 18,000 Kelvin, which is the ionized gas temperature. And what seems to be going on is this mild heating of the gas is, I think, in part preventing the gas from collapsing to higher densities, and in part diffusing these high densities a little bit. So what you end up with is gas which is more diffuse than if you only have supernova feedback. So you see much higher densities in this phase diagram here, and this is the mean density of all gas in this snapshot. And you can see that this is about almost a dex higher than if you have the radiation feedback added. So the heating is sort of preventing the high density peaks from forming. And then the last question I want to ask is, why the hell is radiation pressure not working? So I think many people have been using this multi-scattering as an effective radiation feedback mechanism. But the fact is that we don't have any multi-scattering in our simulation. So what we're seeing here is just the PDF of lines of sight. So this is optical depth along lines of sight through the galaxy at different time steps in the simulation. So every 50 million years. And there are practically no lines of sight at all throughout time in the simulation, where the optical depth, the dust optical depth through the face of the galaxy is higher than one. So it doesn't mean that, you know, in reality there are no optical depths higher than one. It just means that we're not resolving the scales at which they are going to be higher than one. So our resolution, like I said, is about 18 parsec. And on these scales, we're not able to form dense enough peaks in the gas such that the optical depth becomes so high. And I fiddled with, you know, I've tried actually changing the kappa dust, you know, multiply it by a factor of 10, factor of 100, and even if you multiply it by a factor of 100, you actually start getting, you know, optical depths of, you know, order 100. But even that, you're still getting a pretty mild effect from the radiation. It's just damping the star formation rate a little bit more, and you still don't have any outflows. And the most important thing which is going on seems to be just the radiation heating. And for now, that's about it. Of course, I'm going to continue with more massive halos. I think that will be very interesting, where you should get higher optical depths. I mean, the main conclusion, I think, is just that the radiation feedback we're getting seems to be working in a pretty gentle way, and maybe helping the supernova a little bit and being a little bit more effective. And the main effect from the radiation is just the radiation heating. And that's it. Thank you.
Okay, so it's always impressive when someone gets radiative hydrodynamics working and so on, because I don't want to have to do that if I can avoid it, of course. So if you're finding that radiative pressure is not really having that much of an effect, it's radiative heating, do you think that we could kind of replicate that effect just by, you know, applying a diffuse energy field, or by just pumping up the supernovae to be bigger than a supernova should really be, to get the same kind of thing happening?
So I think a very important thing here is the continuous feedback by the radiation. So it starts just when the particle is born, and it continues to go on until the supernova goes off, basically. And I think that's a very important effect that should be included. And I think some people are including that in their simulations by just injecting continuous energy into some bubble around your particle. And it remains to be seen whether, I think it would be a nice test to see if I can reproduce pretty much the same effect by just doing that, just skip the radiative transfer altogether.
I wanted to comment a couple things. So first of all, I wanted to draw a link between this talk and the talks by Pellegrini and Lopez yesterday, because what they're constraining is precisely this, what you're calling radiation heating, and its relevance compared with radiation pressure and clearing the environment where the explosions are going to happen. And that's something that you can like I said, get a handle on using line ratio diagnostics in real galaxies. And also I wanted to mention that the outcome of that ought to be dependent upon the mass of the star cluster that you're forming, as well as the density and pressure of the medium, both of which affect the balance there. And you expect to have a higher effect for radiation pressure where you have a more massive cluster and a higher ambient medium density.
Okay. Okay.
Maybe I missed it, but did you do calculations to show the effect of having both radiation pressure and supernova feedback on the mass loading factors that you measure?
On having only radiation pressure?
Having both, so compared to just supernova.
On the mass loading?
Yeah.
No, I didn't do a direct comparison, but in any case, I mean, with or without the radiation, your winds are basically unchanged. We actually saw that you know, where was it? Here. So this is the wind with radiation turned on, right?
Yeah.
And this is the wind with radiation turned off. It decreases a little bit, okay, factor of 3, but the star formation is also decreasing by almost the same factor. So
okay.
The mass loading is about the same.
Okay.
And radiation is like passive in terms of winds here.
And which supernova model is used in this?
This is just thermal dump. So that's
okay.
Also something that I want to explore to add slightly more efficient supernova feedback. I mean, we're almost getting on to the Kennedy-Smith relation, so we need something a little bit stronger here.
Okay, thanks.
More questions?
I just wanted to clarify with these Kennedy-Smith relations, you're actually imposing a Schmidt law with index 1.5, right?
Yeah.
For your star formation.
So, star formation law, indeed.
So what we're seeing here is basically variations in thickness. Is that the only thing we're seeing here? I mean, how should we interpret the slopes of these curves?
The slopes, I think, come primarily, indeed, from the star formation law that you apply in those simulations. There are two things which can happen if you try to increase the feedback. One is that you normalize down. And that's because you're increasing the scale height of your disk. And also you could go, you know, to this direction. You could decrease the largest surface densities of gas. And that's just by smoothing out the on the radial scale, sort of. And in the case here of radiation, you seem to be mostly just puffing up the disk.
But the areas on which you're measuring surface density, the area that you normalize by, is that similar to the area over which you measure volume density? I mean, in terms of physical scale?
Is it similar to the cell width?
Yeah. Is it the same?
No, this is a few. I mean, each radial bin is a few cell widths. I don't remember on the top of my head, but I would guess it's 100 parsec or something like that.
Okay.
In width. Which is like 5 cell widths.
I have a general question to this pressure floor. How much energy and momentum is injected by applying this?
I have no idea.
Has someone ever looked at that?
So indeed, this is, and I didn't mention that, this is a form of feedback as well, right? You're putting in some artificial pressure, and actually in some papers this has been explicitly cited as being feedback. But no, I haven't checked what kind of energy you're putting in.
I don't know how it compares to.
No. I did experiment with just removing this pressure floor completely, because if you remove it, in theory, you would get much higher densities, higher optical depths and so forth. And it still has a very mild effect on what happens.
Any more questions? Two questions in one session. I don't know if it's allowed. Okay, Chris, you can answer.
Sorry, I'm in a good mood. I just had chocolate. I just wanted to mention, in response to the question of whether you can sidestep the radiation heating, there are relatively robust models for that effect that are analytical. and be possible to sidestep it by implementing those models before the supernova exploded.
You need some scale at which to inject that energy, right?
There's a theory for that.
Yeah, okay. And that, well, that's going to be dependent on
On the local properties of the gas and on the stars that you have there. So you have to know something about those two things.
Yeah.
Okay, Richard.
Yeah, apologies that this is, again, belaboring that point. I don't believe that. This was originally what was tried for radiation on small scales by ourselves and other groups, and there's no way to get the thermodynamics right. Oh, just the photo evaporation. They don't have a comment about that. But if we're talking about diffuse radiation, thermal heating, etc., there's no simple way to do that without doing the radiation. All right. That might be possible.
Okay. Last question. If not, I think we should retire to coffee. We return at 3:50. Second speaker again.